So good afternoon. Now we are going to start the afternoon session, second session. The title is Today's Initiatives and Problems. So I'd like to introduce you, the moderator, Professor Marcelo Buccelli, Professor of University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. His specialty is business history. Could you please start?
Okay. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to our session, to the second part of this event. I was introduced already, I am Marcelo Buccelli, and I am going to chair the following two sessions. For the first one, we're going to have the following two speakers. I'm going to start introducing Ken Shibusawa, who is the CEO of the Japan Center for International Exchange, the chairman and founder of Common Asset Management, and who has had a long experience also in the financial sector and has written extensively in philanthropy, ethics, and non-for-profit businesses. So, please... Mr. Shibusawa, you can go ahead.
Okay, Marcel, thank you very much, and thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Ken Shibusawa, and it's an honor and privilege to be addressing you today at the OECD, and thank you for my convener, Patrick, for arranging this for us. Today, I wanted to share my thoughts with you regarding sustainable capitalism. My background, I don't know if you have my bio, but in my 20s and 30s and 1980s and 1990s, I worked at U.S. hedge funds and U.S. American banks and U.S. hedge funds in the financial markets. Very, very shortism. But why is it now that I am doing this kind of long-term sustainable capitalism? I wanted to share some thoughts with you regarding this. Longo and soroban is a keyword that I'll be discussing with you today, and there was some discussion this morning. This is longo. Which is the Analects of Confucius, which is it's hard to say in English almost, so I'll just say longo. But this basically represents, as we had in the morning session, ethics. on the other hand, this is the abacus. I don't know what, maybe our Western friends here hasn't really seen an abacus before, but it kind of looks like this. It's called soroban in Japanese. It's the original handheld calculator, and you need to calculate to do business. And so this represents business. And so today, with my talk regarding sustainable capitalism, I want to walk you through what my thoughts are regarding this. But it's not so much about looking back in the past. With you, I want to discuss with you with basically the future. Now, when people think about the future, I think many people tend to draw their views of the future in a straight line. So back in 1990, at the peak of the Japanese bubble, we thought that our growth was going to be, going straight forward, and it didn't. And now in Japan, we have the Abenomics, which have brought some back a little bit of, regeneration of sort of growth in Japan. But still, we're plagued with low birth rates and whatnot, aging population, and so we're still sort of thinking, looking at the future in a straight line. But I think the future doesn't arrive in a straight line, and the hint lies here. It says history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. It's not from a famous history professor, but actually it comes from our Mark Twain. And I think from this, when it says rhyme, I think I kind of interpret this as being like a rhythm or a cycle. And so here, just wanted to share with you in the Japan's experience what has been the modern era historical cycle that Japan has been sort of experiencing. 1990 was the peak of the Japanese bubble. I was born in 1961. So since I was born, in the first 30 years of my life, basically, Japan saw very high economic growth. We were called Japan as number one in the 70s, 80s. This 30 years was a years of prosperity, basically. But what about the 30 years prior to that? And these were the war years. And the war years, it's basically a time when the old normal became the new normal. A lot of destruction. So these 30 years was basically period of destruction. What about the 30 years prior, 1900 to 1930s? In 1904, 1905, there was the U.S.-Russo war, and I think this was an indication that Japan had very quickly actually caught up with the West. And so maybe this 30-year period can be also be characterized as an era of prosperity for Japan. And what about the next 30 years prior? This was the Meiji Restoration. And, of course, the Meiji Restoration was all about the old normal of the Edo period, which lasted about 260, 70 years. And it was all about trying to make a new normal. So I think these years was also a years of destruction. So you know, these are sort of loose sort of cycles. There's not a line there that really, you know, that switches into the old to the new. but I think you can kind of see this rhythm where Japan, after the Meiji Restoration, had 30 years of destruction, 30 years of prosperity, 30 years of destruction, and 30 years of prosperity. And so my thesis is that perhaps, you know, we're seeing the present day as the lost decades, lost 10, lost 20, but maybe we're in the 30 years of destruction and we're in the 23rd year of that. And so assuming that this kind of historical cycle exists, and if you sort of compared this with a 24-hour day, where the prosperity years is the daylight, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., I noticed in Paris it gets doesn't get light until about 8 o'clock. But let's say 6 to 6. That's the, you know, it's times of prosperity. And then for the evening, from 6 o'clock in the evening to 6 o'clock in the morning, assuming that's destruction. And then basically what it's telling us is right now we're at 3 a.m. And 3 a.m. is a time of the day, unless you're very, very jet lagged, that you are asleep and you want to move. And maybe that's sort of the time period that we're in at the current time frame in our historical cycle in Japan. If we compared this, let's say, a calendar year, where spring and summer are the years of prosperity, so April to May, through September, and destruction is fall and winter, so that's October to March. We're basically in February right now in Japan. So very, very cold, and we don't want to leave the house. We just want to stay inside. So maybe that's what's happening right now. I kind of propose this with you, saying that when I said 30 years of destruction, or in the areas of 30 years of destruction, sounds very, very negative. But I think we're at a period where, you know, the nighttime is not bad because the nighttime is about resting your body for the next day. And the winter is not bad because it's about preparing for the next season. So as I, when I'm out in Japan talking to individual actual investors about this economic cycle, that I tell them that, you know, if every Japanese person kind of realizes this and sort of moves on forward, that, you know, we don't need to be so pessimistic that the future comes in a straight line, that actually it comes in large cycles like this. And it's very important to figure out where we are in this large economic, or this big wave of the economic cycle. So this is a sort of the background of why I think meaning behind Nongo and Soroban is important. It's not about looking back in the past, but it's about learning from the past so that we can go into the future. Now, I want to share with you genten, which is origin in Japanese. Many of you have been to Japan. Tokyo Chuoku Nihonbashi Kabuto-cho 43. This is an address. Kabuto-cho in Japanese, for many people in Japan, you think of the Tokyo Stock Exchange. It's in Kabuto-cho. But from the Tokyo Stock Exchange, if you walk about probably about 100 steps, you come to this building. Looks like any other building in Japan. On the corner, you see there's a plate there. and that plate, and it says, in Japanese actually, but it says the bank's birthplace. At this very spot, about 100 and, let's say, 30, 40 years ago, this building was there. This was the first National Bank of Japan, which Eiichi Shibusawa, who's established this company, and is also known to have established about 500, or involved in the establishment of 500 companies. There's not much of a family resemblance, but Eiichi Shibusawa was my grandfather's grandfather. when we think of the word a bank in Japan or any other place, we know exactly what a bank does. But if you think about it, back in 1872-73, when this bank came into existence, a bank didn't exist back then. So a bank back then was a new venture business. So what did Shibusawa Eiichi use? How did Shibusawa Eiichi convey the message? What is a bank? It's a very new concept. He used this phrase in the public offering memorandum. Of course, in Japanese, not English, but basically translated, he said a bank is like a mighty river. Money that does not gather there is merely a puddle or of water or dripping dewdrop. So even though it has the ability to bring wealth to the people and the nation, its effects aren't realized. So money is obviously a very valuable resource, but if it's spread around, if it's dripping around, it doesn't bring wealth to the people or the nation. And so if it comes to the bank, then it'll be the driving force for the development of that economy. And if you look back in Japan during the Meiji, Taisho, and the Showa period, the money from the Japanese people came to the bank, and it supported the industrial the growth of Japan through the banking system. So this basically was, I think, the basis of capitalism as we knew in Japan. This was the origin. After the Lehman shock, capitalism became kind of a bad word. But I believe that the origins of capitalism is not so much about making money for yourself now, but it's about for the future, and it's about bringing together your resources and go for that common objective. Because Shibusawa Eiichi was involved in establishing about 500 companies, he's often known as the father of Japanese capitalism. But it's interesting that he's never really used the word shihon shugi too much in his context. He did use the word gappon shugi, which was introduced this morning in the morning session. And so to me, what is the difference between capitalism and gappon? And capitalism, of course, comes from the Latin word capita, which means head. And so to me, for capitalism, you need this main actor called the head. And the head is a very wise, entity. So it knows how to make choices. You know, what's advantage? What is more advantageous? What is more profitable? And so it has that ability. So capitalism needs the head to make these sort of decisions. Okay, so in the morning, Kikao-sensei talked about there's no English word for gappon. It's a little bit different from capitalism the way I described it, because it's all about sort of drops of dewdrops coming together to form one sort of mighty river. This sort of kind of brought to me images not so much of being advantageous or profitable, but more about being effective, or more about common values. Common values meaning why did the money come to a bank? Because basically they're looking for low-risk safety, right, especially in our modern world. It might come to a hedge fund because you want to make money. It might go to some social enterprise because you want to do social good. There has to be some common value, common objectives. Otherwise, the dewdrops will not come together into one gappon or one entity. So me, just kind of thinking through this, to me, a good translation for gappon to me is actually corporatism, which is sort of a different concept with capitalism. But I think in this aspect, it's illustrative. The reason why I say this is because the root word from corporatism actually comes from a Latin word, corpus, which means the body. And so for me, if there was a big large stone, and one individual could not move that stone. One body couldn't move it. If he gathered his friends, and if the different kinds of bodies came and pushed, but you need to push towards the same direction, right? You can't push towards different directions. But if you push towards the same direction, that large stone will move. So what's capitalism? There's a big stone, one individual, can't move it. But the head is very smart, right? And so he finds this really long lever, and he uses leverage to move the stone. Very, very clever, right? You can do it by one person. And it's very clever, and the stone rolls. But if that stone stops for some reason, if that stone rolls the other way, then you got the leverage going the other way, and you might get hurt unless you're careful. So it might be sort of a fine line difference between capitalism and gappon, but I think listening to Kikao-sensei's talk this morning, we're talking about basically the same thing. I mean, you're gathering resources from all around, bodies from all around, and basically you're pushing towards one common objective, and that's why the stone rolls forward. This is Seattle, Washington. Now, do you know what Seattle is famous for in Seattle, in the United States? Some people might think Starbucks coffee. Some people might think of Amazon. Actually, Seattle is known for its really bad weather, and so it always rains. But this day, this particular day, it was beautiful. Beautiful weather. But I was taking this picture, but I had a very, 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 very heavy cloud actually over my heart. And the reason was, if you look at this blue sky, there's not a single plane flying in that blue sky. And the reason why there's not a single plane flying there was because the date was 2011, September 11th. So it was 9/11. This was the morning of 9/11, and I was planning to fly from Seattle, Washington, D.C. Obviously, the plane never took off. And here I was stuck in Seattle, Washington, looking at this blue sky. I had just started my company 6 months prior in March of 2001. 2001. My first son was born the previous year, and I think my second son my wife was carrying the second son. And here I was stuck in Seattle looking at this blue sky, and I thought, gosh, is this how war starts? Because my generation have never really experienced war, and I just didn't know what that felt like. But I was thinking, is this how war starts? Until then, I was in the financial markets, and Windows Phone. Sorry, this came up. And I was in the financial markets, and my job was I would get on the phone and move, tens of millions, hundreds of millions, billion dollars on a phone. But here I was starting my company with small children, and there's not a single plane flying. So there's no people flying. There's no goods moving. And how was I gonna make a living going forward? This was sort of a day of just a wake up call for me. And the wake up call for me was that we take peace for granted, and peace is like air, right? I mean, you take air for granted until it's taken away from you, and so. And so this was a day of wake-up call, and on this particular day, we had all our plans had been halted, and on the radio, I believe, there was a call for us to everybody to gather at the International Fountain. We had no plans, so the group of us that I was traveling with, we go to this park called the International Fountain, and this is what it looked like. And people just gathered there. This is the United States, so there was all kinds of people, young and old, all kinds of ethnic groups. There was no public speech or anything, but people just gathered here. And why did they gather? Because we all shared common values. And what that common value was I think, this word, sustainability. At this juncture, we gathered one for common value as we were mourning the souls of thousands of people that lost their lives a couple hours ago in New York. But at the same time, I think all of us there, we had just no idea what was going to go on from there. What about our lives going forward for myself, ourselves, our children, our parents, our friends, you know, our colleagues. We just didn't really have an idea. We didn't know what was going to happen, but I think everybody shared this common value that we had to do something, and so we gathered. And so I think this is the power of common value, and the one particular common value that really sort of ties us all together is this concept of sustainability. One touching moment, actually, at this point was a group of five or six, obviously Islamic people, men came, and they're actually on this left side, and they put some flowers in front of the fountain. And what happened afterwards then was everybody, this entire crowd, they started clapping. And so I think this sort of feeling about sustainability of your friends, your family going forward, it's something that's shared by, you know, all kinds of people across the world, you know, whether you're American, European, Japanese, or Islamic, or, you know, any other nation. So I brought up this concept of sustainability, and I want to compare the status quo with you. The status quo is actually pretty important because, especially for industrialized nations, because we have a vibrant economy, and we need to keep the status quo to keep it, you know, going. The problem with, especially because I think we're talking at the OECD, is that the developed countries have a problem right now because the status quo is about sort of taking care of the social welfare system and our economic infrastructure. And how are we doing this? We're doing this on borrowed money with fiscal deficit. And how are we going to pay back that fiscal deficit? Well, we really don't know. So basically, we're using monetary policy to push things forward, you know. And so, to me, eventually, I guess, you know, the economists will tell you that we'll eventually see economic growth again, and we'll get higher tax revenues, and we can pay back the debt. But even in that case, I think what we're doing in this model is basically saying, you know, we'll eat first and we'll pay you later. And who are we eating from? We're eating from the future generation of people in Japan or Europe or America that haven't even been born yet, possibly. Yeah? And so basically, it's sort of a situation where our democratic system can't answer to, because democratic system can only answer to people that are actually here and actually can go vote. But actually, what's happening right now is that we're eating the growth of future generations that are not able to express their opinions through the democratic system as we know it in the usual sense. So I think that's the danger actually of status quo. So what about the sustainability? And when people think of sustainability, I think they think about the future. But I think it's not really about the future. And the reason why I say this is, let's say a company makes capital investments. And why do they make that investment? Because that company in the future want to make sure that their corporate value can be increased, that it can keep on growing. But you don't do the capital investment in the future, you do it now, right? And so basically, to me, the capital investment is right now reallocation of resources and capital. And capital and resources means things like financial. It could be the goods, it could be human, and it could also be time. But basically, what sustainability is not about the future, I think, but it's about now, making the decision now for the future. And so. That's why, you know, it's very important for us to gather here at this moment and think about sustainability, because it's not about taking actions for the future, but actually doing your actions today. So what is this Rongo and Soroban? Well, for one, it's a book, actually. My great-great-grandfather had made many lectures and comments and whatnot, and it's in a book form, right, basically. And from there, I'm just taking a couple of excerpts in it. And one was called a chapter called Rational Management. And in that, he says that even if an executive individually becomes very, very wealthy, many people in that society suffers in poverty, that even his happiness will not last. I think you're here. and when I when I This kind of reminds me of what sort of, it's a different time and it's a different place, but what, you know, what was Arab Spring about? And I thought, well, it's probably about the fact that there was a single dictator that he and his family were very, very wealthy and they're very, very happy for, you know, maybe for many, many years, decades. But that wealth and that power did not sort of, you know, it was not shared by many in the society. And so as a result, that dictator's happiness and his family's happiness did not last. And he also, H also said that, you know, he said that if that wealth is not achieved through the proper way of doing things, that wealth cannot last. So I think we're talking about that happiness not lasting, wealth not lasting. And so to me, Rongoto Soroban is talking about is about sustainability. To me, it's the same thing. For a business sustainability, obviously you need to calculate things. You need the soroban. Otherwise, it's not sustainable. But I think what the message here is that if that's the only thing you're doing, perhaps maybe it's not it won't last for a long time. It might be not sustainable. On the other hand, let's say you're very, very that you're ethical. You know, you're very, very moral. That's fine. That's great. But if that's the only thing that you're doing, then nothing will move forward, and so that's not sustainable either. And so the most important word in longo and soroban is actually the word and, I think. It's not or. It's not longo or soroban. It's longo and soroban. And so if you sort of imagine the two wheels on one side, and one side is bigger and another side is smaller, what happens is you kind of go in the same place in circles, right? But if it's both on the same size, then obviously you can go straight for sustainability towards the future. So to me, what Longo and Soroban, back then when my great-grandfather was talking about this, actually was in his later years, when Japan was actually prosperous, but he feared that if things go on, that prosperity will not be sustainable. That's why he brought this notion about Longo and Soroban actually in the Taisho era. So it's actually that we saw the super growth after this. We saw the super growth period in the Meiji Restoration era. So I think Longo and Soroban, in one word, is we're talking about sustainability. That's me in the center there. my youngest sister is still a baby, newborn, so this must be back in 1965, right during the super growth period of Japan. This is today. I have three boys. We live in different eras. When I was growing up and when my children are growing up, totally different era. But I think there are some commonality between the two ages, two eras, and I think it's this that I think my parents for our children thought, you know, wanted to have a better tomorrow than today. It's the exact same thing that I hope for my children, and I would imagine that it's the same thing that. Yeah, I'm sure you were children of your parents, you know, and you're the father and mother of children, and probably thinking the same thing, you know. And this is the common value I think that's shared, again, by not just the industrialized nations, but also the developing nations anywhere. That you know you want a better tomorrow than today for the next generation. And to me, this is a very, 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 very important resource. But it's like a dewdrop that's basically just dripping away all around. And so I had sort of, after my wake-up call and after Lehman shock and whatnot, I launched a mutual fund back in 2008-09, right during the Lehman financial crisis. And the proposition for here is actually for a better today, for tomorrow than today, for the next generation. Basically, what we're doing is it's long-term capital for the next generation. Our basic clientele, our individual investors, most of them, 50% are people in their 30s and 40s. 16% are actually minors. So basically parents that are putting aside their like $100, $200 every month for their futures, for their children's future. So this is not people that have a lot of money. But these are the people in the Japan context, the generation that needs the money 30 years hence. Because right now, the business model in the Japanese financial industry is to get the money from people that have the money, which is people 60s, 70s, and 80s, which is a fine business model for now. But the question is that sustainable going forward? Unless that wealth is transferred to the next generation in one way or another. Unless there is stock building for this generation, what we call the post-baby boomers, the baby boomer juniors. So I think in closing, I just want to mention that for a financial institution, I think there are three primary roles or responsibility that a financial institution like ourselves, which is where we're an asset management company, that plays. And one is taking, obviously, the funds from the private sector, individuals, households, to the sector that does the economic activity, which are the companies. And if there's a return, you know, give that back to the individual. So it's this sort of cycle of capital from the household to the economic activity. That's one, and the financial sector is supporting that. That's one important, I think, aspect of it. The second important aspect of it, I think, is this generational, especially in Japan, but I think all of the industrialized nation have share the same problem or same sort of problem that we need to bring the wealth from the prior generation to the next generation. So this sort of vertical sort of transfer of wealth. And my proposition also that there's a third element, a role that the financial institution should play, and that is to transfer the funds that's from the profit sector to the nonprofit sector. and we do this by, you know, we donate 1% of our revenues to support social entrepreneurship. And I don't call this, I don't call it philanthropy, I don't even call it CSR in a sense, but I call it, it's what financial institutions should be doing. And what giving donation to finance social entrepreneurship, it may not give us the immediate return, especially financial return, but what those individuals are doing is they're actually going out there, starting their either businesses or organizations to solve social problems. And to me, and for a better tomorrow than today. So for me, donating, supporting social entrepreneurship is a long-term investment. And so, as a financial institution, I think there's a role that we can play in that. So my sort of comments kind of went in very, very many different directions, but hopefully that you were able to sort of pick up a little bit of tidbits of information and whatnot, and I'll look forward for the discussions, open discussion with you later. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken, so much. Well, we're going to leave the questions for the end of the two sessions. And our next speaker is Mr. Lionel Xinzhu. He's the chairman of PAI Partners and the CEO since 2009. He has occupied several executive positions at Danone, and he used to teach economics at the University of Paris. So for the next 30 minutes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much for your invitation. Having to speak of ethics and being the chief executive officer of a private equity firm, it's quite a challenge. It's quite original. I tend to think it's very legitimate, but as you know, public opinion is not necessarily of that view. And I would say many countries share the view that it's not clear that private equity is the fastest and shortest conduit to ethical behavior and sustainable capitalism. Not that many. I understand it was not a good proposition for a candidate to being president of the United States, to have been a founder of Bain Capital, one of the most respected private equity firms. I understand that even a Tory government in the UK had reservations on many aspects of private equity. I understand that the Lady Chancellor of Germany has made many observations against private equity, and together with France has pushed to write a directive, so a European law, on alternative investment firms, which have strengthened regulations with a bit of a repressive will against a mixture of hedge funds and private equity firms. And my memories of Japan, where I've been a lot, is that the pension funds in Japan are the least involved in funding private equity in the world, with quite clear reservations against the social role of private equity firms. So in this respect, I appreciate that you have been brave enough to give me the floor on defending the idea that private equity is something which is useful and can be done in a sort of honorable way, and that throughout the current financial crisis, many new avenues to prove that it can be an honorable sort of financial practice are now pioneered. Having said that, to give you an idea, I was in front of the students, the promising students of one of the French well-known graduate schools called École Polytechnique. And you speak to the 500 students, and then they give you marks. And my subject was the same in a sense. Is it efficient? Is it useful? Is it ethical to be an investor, professional investor? And I was very, very pleased because I got the best mark of the year among the corporate executives they have received in terms of entertainment, 85% satisfied. And then coming to, have you been convinced? It was 20%. So you can entertain people. It's not absolutely clear that you can easily convince them. And I think it will be a long time before we can convince people of what we do and that we can do it with certain degree of honorability and responsibility and sustainability. Because I think it, beyond this session today, it could last sort of 1,000 years before we achieve this goal. Because if you remember the first pages of Karl Marx in Das Kapital, he has a reference to Aristotle explaining that there are two ways of making money. One, which can be justified, which is the sphere of economics. It's using finance for the real economy. And the other one that he calls crematistic, so crematistic from crema, the wealth in Greek, crematistic, which is to use money to make money, which is awful. And it was not clear for me that in the Greek temples, the sophistication of financial techniques was so advanced, but clearly it was advanced, and making money for the sake of making money, profit for profit and not profit for the real investment in the real economy, was already very clear in Aristotle's mind. And it was fresh enough for Karl Marx to refer to that. And I suspect then it will last a bit of a while because this difference is well entrenched. And we explain that being a professional investor is about financing the real economy on a sustainable and responsible way when it's unclear that we are exactly perceived that way. So first, I would like to just enlighten a few paradoxical features on what is private equity. If I simplify, private equity is about investing in buying firms through leveraged buyout and developing them and selling them back, usually having owned them for average 4 to 6 years. And to do that, to perform that, funding those investment policies by borrowing the money on a sort of period of 10 to 13 years. But you have to go back to your investors in between 10 years and 13 years after the beginning of the initial investment period with some return. Because it's the most illiquid and technically one of the longest in terms of duration among the possible investment asset classes. So you have variants of that. It can be more debt and less equity for very mature firms. It can be more equity and less debt if you are in venture capital or growth development. So if you are buying and reselling companies which are at a time in their development when they burn cash and not generate free cash flow. So it can be you have variance in this universe. You can have longer term horizons if you are financing infrastructures. But by and large, you could summarize everywhere in the world this business in the financial world as one of long-term financing, because to arrange today, in the world of today, to arrange debt as we do every day, this firm, PEI, is the leading private equity firm in France and one of the leading in continental Europe. Our daily work is to arrange financing with a duration of 7 to 10 years. To finance companies which are typically mid-sized to large-sized companies, but typically with a sort of total enterprise value around 1 to 2 billion euros. So large cap, say, but not large enough to be able to secure 7 years to 10 years financing easily in the market as it is, where it's difficult to find long-term, and in a sense it has been discouraged to put in place long-term financing with the evolution of banking regulation, which is discouraging long-term debt, as well as the insurance regulation in the EU. So we are doing this job to be in a position to put in place long-term debt financing and equity, so permanent financing, plus a bit of professionalism in the way we behave as shareholder. It's the definition of our job. And when we succeed is when we have taken a mid-sized company and transformed it, converted it in a large company. And it's where we have the best return. As an asset class worldwide, we deliver the highest return of all asset classes, if you take that on a long period average, because we are the most illiquid, and in a sense, one with a very long-term horizon compared to the stock exchange market primary share market or any other asset class. And we deliver worldwide average 12%. We have done that on the last 25 years, 12% return. Depends on the regions of the world, depends on the business cycles. In the case of my firm, we are sort of quite typical of Europe, being more in the 18% return on equity per year, sustained on the last 20 years. And with that sort of performance, we are average among the good. I mean, we are not sort of abnormal phenomenon. But again, totally illiquid, and we would not raise any dollar, any euro, if we had not that sort of performance associated to a 13 years illiquidity, which by definition is not very attractive if you have not associated to that a high return. And by definition, we have to have investors which are professional investors, which are long-term oriented, so it's pension funds, sovereign funds, insurance companies throughout the world. And it's not individuals, because you do not let an individual, even very wealthy, to put too much of his own personal assets in a firm which will not give you basically any other news than a report every quarter, but absolutely no chance of a return, with a very poor secondary market. So essentially, you are trapped for 13 years. And that, even if we make efforts to give the money back in half the time, sort of 6 years and a half, 7 years, that is a very, very, very special thing in this industry. But it allows the necessary time, which is absolutely not what the public opinion thinks. It gives enough time to change in depth the companies we buy, to accelerate their growth or turn around their performance in case they are in a weaker situation. So that's what we are doing. It's not what we are perceived as doing. We are perceived as doing short-term, with a very short-termist orientation, short-term job, because many people consider that 5 years, 6 years of ownership is very, very short. They have in mind companies with hundreds of years of history and a long vision and so on. The truth is that if you are not able to turn around the company in 5-6 years of efforts, this company has a serious problem, because it's absolutely not what, for instance, the stock exchange market would allow for a management team in terms of duration if they have to turn around the company. And same if they have to show the possibility of a strong growth. They will never wait that long. But it's not the perception. On the Paris Stock Exchange market, which is not different from the other advanced economy stock exchange market, people are average owners of their shares 7 months. So we are very often opposed to the stock exchange market. We are the alternative class, asset class, to the stock exchange market. We are a private universe, private placement, except that we, in a sense, as a shareholder, we have not the length and depth of many family companies, for instance. We have not the history of the Suntory Group or the Saint-Gobain Group or whatsoever. Nevertheless, we are far more, as shareholders, dedicated to creating value on long term than what people think. Second, we, in terms of the perception versus what we are perceived as having no principle in terms of industrial relations, in terms of a sort of decent behavior for achieving restructuring tasks. We are perceived as destroying employment as a normal tool, and all our professional unions, the British Venture Capital Association, as well as the European one, as well as the American one, prove every year that companies owned by private equity firms and under an LBO are creating jobs more than the average companies and deliver growth more than the average corporation. Which is absolutely clear because we select those companies we buy with a luxury of due diligence, of strategic studies, and we probably assemble more skills to evaluate them and then manage them than many other owner. So it's no surprise that during the current crisis, you had a very little amount of bad loans associated to LBOs, very low amount, and that we have been able to prove that we were creating value. The opinion, the public opinion, is totally different from that. People consider certain LBOs which have been failures as typical of the industry. So we are judged by the exceptions. So Grohe in Germany is the typical example. Blue Cross and the bankruptcy of Blue Cross in the clinic service business in the UK is a typical example. Each country has a sort of iconic and emblematic failure bankruptcy. And our industry is only measured by its exceptional failures. We have to live with that. Again, people will consider that the rates of return are not normal. They are extra normal. To deliver 12% worldwide across decades, or 18%, is just not normal. Cannot be achieved by normal process. Nobody is aware that in a group, a manufacturing normal corporate group which is not under LBO, when you rank your industrial projects, they have to deliver an internal rate of return, which is usually in Europe 15% or beyond. And it's very rare, except if you are in very capital-intensive industries, it's very rare that you select internally projects with a lower return and with a long payback. It doesn't exist. But the public is absolutely not familiar with those criteria. Personally, I've started my career as an academic under supervision of Professor Fridanson. And then my ethical behavior has been terrible because I went from a university to a manufacturing group, Danone. Then I had to manage Ajinomoto Danone for a while. But then I did worse, became an investment banker in Rothschild. Then I had to manage Nomura Rothschild. And then I did worse, I came to PI, Paribas Affaires Industrielles. So my memory of ethics is back to university and industry. But I tell you, the criteria are the same when you want to invest for a very honorable yogurt factory in Kawasaki or when you are, as we do currently, investing in buying firms within Paribas Affaires Industrielles. But again, convince people of that would require a long, long education to what is the financial contribution to well-being in the world. And I'm not sure that just After 6 years of the crisis we have just gone through, it's easy to explain the contribution of finance to well-being. But there is something in ethical terms which is quite interesting, is that in many countries, the views on private equity is not shared the same way. And as the CEO of a European firm, I'm asked every other day, when are you prepared to develop a fund and a firm, subsidiary, whatsoever, in emerging and developing markets? And today, after all the incentives given by China to private equity, by India to private equity, by Brazil to private equity, now is the age when every other day I have requests from Latin America and Africa. Why? Because long-term debt plus equity in countries with high growth plus professionalism in the role of shareholder in order to strengthen the managerial practices and benchmark and cause those practices to evolve, all that are the missing pieces for developing countries. And strangely enough, I don't know if our job is ethical, but the vast majority of the world, it's what I'm telling to my socialist friend, because I've been in the prime minister's office in this country, and the man is today the minister of foreign affairs, so I have socialist friends. And former colleagues. And I tell them, you don't like private equity, but we don't care, because you see sort of 5 billion people out of 7 who want sort of urgently the development of private equity in their sphere, because it's exactly what is missing to succeed in reducing poverty. When people come to me, I'm also partly African, so they come more easily to me, saying, we need you to fund either in growth capital or in LBO, but we need you to fund African development. There is no element of an ethical judgment that we would do that with a view of being short-termist or destroying employment. Doesn't exist. It's about improving dramatically their path to growth and development. Having said that, it's very, very important to see how much this crisis we have gone through has improved our long-term efforts to be honorable people. First, we are forced now to be honorable, and the regulations on our business are clearly far stronger on every element, which are perceived as typical of financial exuberance. So we are limited in the sort of leverage we can put on a company. We are incentivized to disclose to public authorities, investors, but also unions, what are our goals, what are our performance, how we achieve them. I mean, the need of disclosure and the cost of disclosure and transparency, all that is up very significantly. And it is a huge, huge progress, because it was a very secretive industry. It starts to be open and sort of decently transparent. That is the main effect of all the regulations. Plus, so we take less risks and we say more what we are doing, so that people are decently informed and reduce also their own level of risks. We have not been a cause of systemic risk at all in the last crisis. At a point in time, people said, after the subprime scandal and the subprime crisis, you will have the consumer credit and credit card collapse, which never happened. And just after that, you will have the LBO collapse. And you will go against a wall of debt. Okay, this wall is a wall which is a bit further every year, so we have not yet impacted this wall of debt anywhere in the world. But we have not been a cause of systemic risk, but the level of risk we could take on board has been dramatically reduced. Is that ethical? No, it's practical. But when you have to disclose everything you do to the regulators, the investors, and the employees of the firm you own in your portfolios, you have to behave differently. Another thing which is very typical in what happened is that we have developed more and more what Ken, you described as moving some capital from the profit sector to the non-profit sector. Each and every significant firm of private equity, including ours, even if it's not really in the French DNA, has made efforts towards the community, community work. We have created a foundation dedicated to supporting efforts to employ and make employable people who have, for social or personal or physical reasons, difficulties to be employed and to create more jobs for people excluded from employment. But it's quite typical. You said 1% of your revenue in our firm, it's 1% of our revenue as well. So it means what? It means we have probably 1% of moral sort of moral feeling or moral commitment. I think it goes far beyond 1%. We do not communicate on that. It's not public relations. It is two things. One, for the employees, it's about rehearsing the real values, understanding why they work in investment firms by the way they act with a lot of pro bono work. And it's impressive. Everybody in the firm wants to be associated. Everybody. So it means people do not cannot have a personal behavior which is different from their corporate behavior. It's a bit reconciled, and it's quite new. The second thing is that our investors, who are our investors? They are the rank and file, the average common man. I mean, they are people paying life insurance, people clients of banks, people saving for their pension, everywhere, and the citizens having the benefit of sovereign wealth fund. So billions of final clients. And more the institutional investors have to prove to the final client that they act on an ethical way, that they have selected the firms they work with criteria where you have all the elements of moral values associated to performance. And they start their due diligence on us now. It was not the case in 2006, 2007. They start all their due diligence by checking what are your values and how do you put that in practice. And the last trend is to be responsible not only in terms of social responsibility and governance, but also in environmental terms. And again, it comes from our employees and the employees of the firms we own. In PI, we own 17 firms with 200,000 employees. It's quite a large group of people. When you are responsible, accountable in front of 200,000 people, you cannot behave in terms of environmental sustainability as if you were a little firm of 50 professionals. It's very different. And same with our investors. Environment now comes first. And when speaking with Japanese funds, for instance, environment comes first, social responsibility vis-à-vis the employees and the community comes second, and at a very high level, I have to say, compared to other countries, governance, where we have to improve and prove that we improve and prove that we have tests and that we measure our improvements. So in a sense, the crisis has made us a bit more ethical, and I have to say, for the sustainability of our industry, it's absolutely key. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you very much for our two speakers. And now we have 15 minutes to open the floor for questions. I think the first thing I learned from this conference is that I need to change my prescription because I really cannot read the names of many of you people. So, I mean, when you raise your hand, I'm sorry if I don't call you by your name. Please, God.
Thank you. Franz Wallenberg from Munich University. Thank you very much for the presentations. One question to Ken Shibuzawa. The 30-year period you mentioned, actually there is a very long cycle behind, and that's demographic change. When Japan counted its population after the opening of during Meiji, you had 40 million. You had about 40 million Japanese. Now at the peak, you had 128 million. And this will decline if nothing happens, if things remain as they are. This will decline to 80 million in 2050. So there's a huge swing. And actually, we don't know how economies behave with declining populations. So isn't there something, you know? Can you be so optimistic about the next 30 years if you know that the population is going down? Question to the to private equity. As an economist, I of course I know the value of capital. I think the problem we have with all these new institutions in the financial system, maybe less with private equity, more with maybe hedge funds and others, is that the risk they can have such leverage. They have such leverage that in the end, when they succeed, of course, it's a huge profit. But when they fail, yeah, they only bear a small portion of the losses. And that was, I think, a source of the financial crisis. And do you see, for example, in the banking industry, I think private equity is not so much the issue, but in the banking industry, for example, that we should not increase the capital requirements just to make it more stable. To sort of not have this huge leverage. Thank you.
Oops. Thank you, Franz, for your question. Regarding demographics, that's one topic that I'm constantly thinking about, actually. And in this 30-year sort of cycle theory, when I start thinking about this about 5 years ago, I was thinking, well, okay, if this is really true, then from 2020, we're supposed to go into this era of prosperity. And I was looking at the trends of the demographics, and you kind of go like, there's no way, right? But something interesting happens in 2020, and it's not just the Tokyo Olympics. what happens in 2020 is actually, it's a period from when actually the population of the baby boomers, that segment starts to go down, right? And so I don't have the answer for you, but one big paradigm shift that's going to start happening 2020 from 2020, 2023, 2024, 2050 is that we're going to be seeing a shift of the most populous part of the population, which is 30s and 40s, or around 40, I'm sorry, around 40. What's sort of interesting is I had a discussion or I had a group of high school student teachers come to my office. We had a little gathering, and these are high school student teachers in public companies that wanted to teach about economics and finance to kids, which in the Japan education context is almost heresy. It's like, you don't do that. You can't teach money to children. But these are sort of people that are younger people, yeah? But they're sort of energized to do this. One gentleman who was an observer, he wasn't a teacher, made an interesting comment saying, like, he's not so pessimistic about the Japan's education system going forward. And I asked him why. And I said, well, because the mandatory retirement age for public school teachers is 60 years old. And in 5 years, a lot of the people that have in the mode of the status quo people are going to be out of the system, basically. And then the younger generation, people in the 40s, they don't know the status. They've never seen growth, and so they're worried more about thinking more about the sustainability part of it. How can they implement the change to make it sustainable going forward? So I think if you give the younger generation room to breathe, that I think there will be innovation, and so Japan's biggest challenge, as you mentioned, is how do you have economic sustainability in a declining population? And my answer would be, you got to have the metabolism within this, within the system, to have the new players coming in with newer innovation. And so, so what I'm saying to you, I guess, is that being optimistic is a choice. it's a choice. And so, I think we're asked right now, do you make a choice to be pessimistic or optimistic? And if you're given the choice, I'd rather be optimistic.
You say that as an economist you were a bit concerned by the risk level, and I can understand that. But you also say that it one of the sources of the crisis, which I think is not true of private equity, but you said immediately after it's maybe more true of hedge funds or other asset classes. I think that in the crisis we had since 2008 or even 2007, you have seen no significant collapse, failure in the system of the most risky part of the private equity industry, which is leveraged buyout. Unsignificant. Why? Because the bad loans have been restructured. In some cases, the minority with the loss, full loss of equity. So then it has been reallocated to new owners who have reinvested. And in the majority of cases, it has been renegotiated, restructured, rescheduled by additional injection of equity. So the question is, do you put more equity up front, or are you to be prepared to remedy when you have issues of the cash flow going dramatically down, and then the indebtedness being unsustainable? Have you to be always prepared to reinject equity and reschedule the financing? I would say it's a choice. It's unclear that in macroeconomics it would be a good idea to allocate more equity, more capital, because it's quite economical, the business model. You do not put too much equity. You have immense merit in financing in long-term debt. You create value through that. But probably you have to be prepared to add up new equity, and it's where you can probably strengthen a bit the regulation, just to make the system safer, but not wasting equity, because we are also a way to reallocate equity in the business world. I mean, it's our essential macroeconomic contribution.
Okay, the next question comes from Professor Hartmut Berghoff.
It's a question for both of you, actually. When was the last time you turned down an investment opportunity for ethical reasons, and where would you sort of see the border between acceptable and unacceptable investment projects in terms of ethics?
We invest in only listed companies, and so in that respect, with through our due diligence, when you invest in something, if the management or if the employees have engaged in some unethical sort of engagement, obviously that's a yellow flag. We don't use ethics as sort of the tool for investing or not investing in a company. It would involve other things like governance. It would involve things like branding, competitiveness and things like that. So it's not, we just don't just take the ethics portion and use that as a parameter to invest or not invest. It'd be a negative screening, obviously, but it wouldn't be a positive. Let's put it that way.
It's very difficult. I mean, I concur with you. It's difficult to say we have a sort of a religious list of the capital sins, and if we are not able to tick all the boxes, we will not invest. But when you have an upfront review of social responsibility and governance, you have to make a judgment. And this judgment has an ethical dimension. So last time is a year ago. I hope you will not discover the company by its profile. It's a leader, French. We like French leaders. In a very environmental friendly industry, with social relations governed by a principle to eradicate the unions, and with governance sort of odd practices, with the main top executive but not owner in a listed company having created personal holdings for real estate in order for the company to sort of fund a personal profit pool, we were just amazed and we immediately abstained. Very efficient company, I mean, delivering profit, but the idea that after due diligence of 1 month we had discovered those in-depth anomalies meant after 1 year we would have discovered mafia system within the firm. So we stopped, shocked.
Just one follow-up is there's a very good question, and the reason why I think it's a good question is that the biggest predicament we have is when we invest in a company that we are confident in their governance infrastructure. They have good governance. We're confident they're good at disclosure, whatnot. But their economic performance has more to be desired, and so do you keep that company with this great governance structure in the portfolio, or do we? Because we only have limited space in the portfolio, so that's the big question for us, and we don't actually have a good concise answer for that.
Maybe just another. Maybe a compliment. I decided that everybody in the firm, starting with the personal assistant, the IT persons, to the most senior investors, will have a full training on corruption and bribery. Both because it is a moral duty, and because the legal framework evolves in each and every country, so people have to be updated and totally transparently trained to that. It's a very, very difficult question. We operate through our portfolio companies in sort of 120 countries. In some cases, we have some business services operations which have to rely on public markets. It's a very, very complex question. The principles are quite clear. Measuring how they are implemented is more complex. Going through everything which is hidden is very complex indeed. Having said that, the cost would be huge in terms of reputation, and it's always a risk. I mean, and our internal controls are terribly stressed. We own a company called Swissport. Swissport is the leader, world leader, of ground handling in airports. In 2 months, we had one employee in Colombia putting kilos of cocaine in a plane, and a few weeks afterwards, people stealing gold from a plane, cargo plane in Zurich. I mean, so you cannot imagine the number of internal control you have to put in place just to be sure that you eradicate. We have 55,000 employees working on 400 airports in all kinds of environments. I mean, it is a significant workload, legal effort, financial effort, training effort. You cannot imagine how ethics is time-consuming and essential.
Well, thank you very much to our two speakers. We're going now to our coffee break, and we'll meet at 4 p.m. here back here. So, thank you.